DeSoto. In third grade, we studied Moses Cleveland. Just the fact that his name had that second A was a lesson in history, and I was already proving to have a knack for spelling. My maiden report cards in the first and second grades were unblemished with a B in any subject, so by the time I got to third, I seemed to be one of the smart kids. This in no way, however, kept me from being intimidated by Mrs. Ruth McIntyre. She was huge in all dimensions, tall, thick, with mountainous rolls of arm, bosom, belly, rear, and thigh, all of her covered every day in a long black dress. Her gray hair was tightly shaped around her florid face, which grew redder and more menacing when she was being stern, which was most of the time. She also was drenched in perfume. Everybody referred to her as Fat Mac, an obvious enough nickname, but it was also a necessary outlet for the terror she struck in us all. The legend of such an ogress was handed down on the playground and at dozens of dinner tables. So even most kindergartners already knew that Fat Mac potentially loomed 3 years into their future. My experiences in the prior grades must at least have introduced me to the potential despotism of teachers, but my path at Fernway School had so far wandered gently through the realms of three quite mild ones. Mrs. Corrine Fox was the kindergarten teacher par excellence. She had white hair, dignity, calm, warmth, and a clear way of speaking down to us. We sat in circles on the floor, played post office, took naps. I believe Miss Barbara Wisely didn't stay long at Fernway. This belief is bound up with the memory of me and another boy peering up her skirt while she stood on a stepladder in the first grade classroom. Miss Wisely was much younger than the other teachers and very pretty, which alone may have been her undoing. Miss Tirza Stahl was a little bird of a woman, small, somewhat frail, old, her first name derived from something unimaginably ancient, but still quite sweet. I think I came into my own as a reader in second grade. Mrs. Fox taught separate kindergarten classes in the morning and afternoon, and there were two first and two second grades. Together with the library, gym, auditorium, and office, these occupied the first floor of Fernway. To proceed to third grade meant climbing the stairs, and Mrs. McIntyre's room was the first one on the right. Unless I go to someone who can assist me in unlocking the past, I remember one and only one time in that year. It happened during a bitterly cold stretch of winter. Northern weather fierce from Lake Erie, with snow on the ground, ice on the walks, no sun, and a stinging wind. Now, my childhood was not fraught with physical hardships, but the fact is we did walk the 8 blocks to school in all kinds of weather. Loved playing in snow, for that matter. So I was used to these conditions and equipped with standard boots and leggings, hooded coat, and gloves. One day, Fat Mac selected me to do her a favor, to go outside and get something from her car. The selection was an honor, I believe, a reward for some academic achievement or other. So I stepped with pride into the cloakroom to don all that winter wear. A chance to leave the classroom was always a thrill, so I don't think I minded at all being sent out into the icebox. Mrs. McIntyre gave me her key ring, showed me which one would unlock the driver's side door, and described the papers I was to fetch. Down the empty stairs, through the silent halls, out the double doors, onto the frozen playground. A chain-link fence divided the play area from the teacher's parking lot. In the long season of baseball, it was the extremely distant right field fence, farther from home plate even than the basketball court in deep right field. Hitting a ball over that fence, perhaps striking a teacher's car, was a thrilling but impossible dream. I picture Mac's car as a green 1951 DeSoto. There it sat in crusty snow. I put the key in the lock, but it wouldn't turn. I twisted it, pulled it out and put it back, waggled and jiggled it, but the key would not turn. I took off one of my gloves and held it with my teeth while my bare fingers got a better grip and carried on the struggle. Very soon, my fingers were numb, thick, awkward, less than useless for doing the job. By now, my vision of the lock was blurred by tears, which arose more from fear of failure than any bodily pain. Through the frost on the driver's window, I could barely make out the stack of papers on the plaid front seat. I put the glove back on, but it restored no warmth to my fingers. I tried using my left hand, but it was too weak, seemingly not even designed for the task. Now, with my right again, I turned the key as hard as I could. Still, the tumbler of the lock wouldn't budge. This time, just the head of the key twisted. The cheap metal had given way, and now when I tried to pull it out, it wouldn't come. I leaned my harness in the opposite direction, desperate to restore the original alignment. That way, at least, if I had to admit failure, I could hand her back the key ring. But the disaster was complete. I had begun wearing glasses in second grade. Between the veil of tears and condensation from hot with shame cheeks meeting ice-cold air on the lenses, I could no longer even see what I was failing to do. Removing the glasses with my gloves didn't change reality. The keys hung motionless on the door. My walk back, even though I was greeted warmly by inside air as I passed through the vestibule, was misery. My boot buckles clinked pathetically in the lonely stairwell. Whatever force I had left was used up opening the door. Everything in the classroom stopped as I walked toward her along the right-hand row of desks. I carried no papers. She looked at me questioningly. I blubbered, stammered, choked out an explanation. Her perfume enveloped me, but neither her arms nor any sympathy did the same. I can't remember any dialogue. Behind me, the class fidgeted with delight in someone else's problem. I slunk to the cloakroom, stayed in there as long as I could until finally, head down, disgraced, I made my way back to my seat. Mac called the office to obtain the services of Mr. Fusco, the custodian, who knew how to fix everything. After a time, he appeared in the room, wearing, as always, his drab blue uniform, an easygoing Italian man, and he handed her the stack of papers and the ring. He laughed as he told her, "That key was frozen in the lock. I had to use my lighter to thaw it out."